Hot Air is a co-production of American University Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
From the campus of American University in Washington, D.C., a collaboration between the American Bar Association's Energy and Environmental Markets and Finance Committee and the American University's Washington College of Law, this is the Hot Air Show, your source for insight, debates, and opinions on energy and climate law, policy, politics, and markets. I'm your host, Chris Barron. Let's go around the table and introduce the panel.
Bill Snape, Center for Biological Diversity, and here from the Washington College of Law.
Toby Short with Duke Energy.
Tyson Slocum, Director of the Energy Program at Public Citizen.
Kevin Buck, Head of the Research Team at Clearview Energy Partners.
It's been a few months since we've had our last Hot Air Show, so there's a lot to talk about today. Front and center on the agenda is EPA's new proposal under 111D of the Clean Air Act. The question for everyone is, has EPA proposed something that will work? I'll start around the table. Kevin?
EPA has proposed something that it is in a very, very mercurial form. States will come back with their own implementation plans, as the listeners to this podcast must well understand. And EPA has modeled a set of scenarios that are based on somewhere between hopes and dreams, and also include a lot of optimism. Now, will it work? Well, the ultimate plan could work. It has to survive, as I'm sure we'll discuss, the legal challenges and the many tests to implementation. It's pretty clear, though, that they've got 8 months, really, from the time they're done taking comments to finish a rule of this scale. It would be silly to imagine that EPA is going to receive commentary and say, oh, that's an interesting new idea. Let's pursue this. I think it's probably appropriate to look at this and conclude, as I'm sure most of you have, that they had a preconceived notion of what they intended to do. And there's been a lot of feedback given and input received, but they're probably going to move ahead with exactly the same program they set out to design a long time ago. Will that work? Well, I think that's going to be very challenging.
Tyson, do you see it because that's what they feel that they can get done right now? A program that has the flexibility not too dissimilar from what we saw at old clean energy standard proposals?
Yeah, I mean, the EPA proposal really has Gina McCarthy's astute fingerprints all over it. I mean, she has navigated some very choppy waters and gave electric utilities a lot of what they wanted to see in this rule. And I think that's why, for the most part, outside of the rural co-ops, most of the utilities have been relatively silent or at least said some polite things about the rule. The folks that have been attacking it the loudest are dead-end industries that are suffering from various market problems, like the coal industry, which is highly segregated and not very diversified, and pure electoral politics. Organizations like the Chamber of Commerce and their ilk. When you look at the groups that actually have stakes in influencing the outcome, I think that you're going to see most utilities willing to play ball because the EPA has punted to the states to develop the details, and I think utilities like their odds in state legislatures and in the various executive branches of the various states. I think that this rule will survive most of the bigger legal challenges, and it essentially will set de facto elements of energy and climate policy going forward.
I mean, Toby, you're always polite.
I'm always polite, but I think that the reason why you haven't heard a lot is because I think the old adage, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything. But more importantly, I'm looking at Bill's – at the Federal Register right here, the rule.
Which I offered to share with you.
Which you offered to share. It's huge. The accompanying documents, I think, were 400 documents that totaled probably 4,000 pages. We're still sifting through it trying to figure out what it all means. A lot of what Kevin said is accurate in terms of it's a lot of assumptions that you hope and dream. And a lot of assumptions that, let's take Georgia and South Carolina and Tennessee, for instance. You got new nuclear being built, which everybody loves and say it's carbon free, but yet you don't take that into account when you're factoring in you can use those to reduce a state's emissions. The second thing is you talked about, will it work? Will what work? What's the purpose of this whole thing? Is it to reduce carbon emissions or to set the BSER outside the fence line and set precedent to go forward and maybe reach into other areas of the economy under other parts of the Clean Air Act?
Well, and that's interesting. I've heard two core formulations that people have offered when they're looking critically at the rule. You know, one is that this is basically de facto resource planning, that they're pushing down on utilities.
But they will tell you, you meet with people at EPA, they will say, no, we've given great deference and great flexibility to the states. Some states seem to think that all they can do is a giant IRP. But no, we've given great deference to them. But at the same time, you're talking about environmental redispatch of natural gas. You're talking about you want nuclear, but if you already are developing nuclear in a state, such as the three states that I said, we're not going to count that. It's only new nuclear. Well, why? But if you're developing renewables in a state, those do count. My question, and the question that we've always talked about here, is a reduction in carbon emissions, a ton of carbon emissions, is a reduction in a ton of carbon emissions, whether it comes from renewables or whether it comes from nuclear, but yet you get penalized in states like that?
Bill, do you see unequal weighting in the choice of the building blocks, the choice of the beyond the fence line measures that entities will have for compliance? Or do you think it's appropriate?
Well, I think whether it's appropriate is a different question. What is that it's heavily tilted towards natural gas. This whole rule is about natural gas and a little bit nuclear, a little bit renewables. I mean, there are some asterisks on the side, but this is all about natural gas. And, you know, you asked the opening question, what does this rule accomplish? The answer is not much when you compare it to what business as usual is going to lead us toward anyway. I mean, what this appears to me to be is some sort of sexy architecture, but it's much ado about nothing. This is just giving in legal template, particularly the natural gas industry, but a lot of related industries, everything they need and want to do the all-of-the-above energy strategy, which is the Obama energy strategy. So this has a lot of bells and whistles in it. The legal wonk in me could talk about things about the rule that I like, but in reality, this is just giving a thumbs up to market forces already taking off. And in terms of the goal I look at, is this going to solve the climate change problem? You know, sorry for the cliche, but it takes a small baby step towards that goal. I don't see it accomplishing what really needs to be done. Is it better than nothing? Yes, but barely.
Interesting. Now, you make the point that market forces are already driving us in the direction. I mean, arguably, many of the supply curves, merit order is already taking on an environmental dispatch, you know, type of framing. You certainly have mid-merit and baseload units that betray that, but we're seeing more and more in the mid part of the curves, you know, gas taking a hold because of the pricing market environment we see right now. In some ways, one could say there are four building blocks. You know, there's more than one. This could be part, you know, be seen as part of an all and above strategy. The question being, though, is, don't we have to have that strategy if the overall metric we're using is CO2e, to kind of, I think, Toby's point?
Well, first, I want to appreciate Bill's comment for recognizing that natural gas is the White House climate policy. It didn't start out that way, but it certainly is now, and that is exactly what this rule seems to be saying. Second, I want to appreciate that the building blocks are options states may take, and of those options, some are more real than others. And third, I want to quantify what we're talking about here. EPA is in their four-block model seeing only a 2.3% or 2.3 BCF a day increase in power sector gas demand in 2020 relative to their baseline. And that's because all these offsetting forces will take care of. Efficiency will dull the thirst for energy, and renewables will slake some of the thirst that remains. But in fact, if you look at their models for the blocks one and two solution, it's 4.9 BCF a day relative to their 2020 baseline, which starts to look a little bit more substantial. That's a chunk equivalent in size to what the market has delivered and Matt's is locked in.
Do you think those numbers include the expected, you know, dramatic increase of distribution level, you know, generation, gas-fired generation, CHP in particular?
Mm-hmm. No. I think actually those are probably lowball numbers relative to what we'll see. Their baseline numbers actually seem generous, and their projections on top of it seem conservative. And among their assumptions is the assumption that there's all this redispatch that happens. What about all the new construction? Well, they've taken a very dim view of new construction. They've decided that there'll be relatively little new CCGT built. And the reason I suspect they're doing that is to minimize the explicit costs that might be borne by the end user.
Well, I mean, one of the things that they modeled in South Carolina was independent power producer in Columbia. And you're talking about a regulated state, first of all, and this is an independent power producer. That ran 20% of the time. They said, well, that could go 70%. And that's the way they did it across the country. And all of a sudden, you're saying you have a state flexibility plan. You know, we're allowing state flexibility, but we're couching it in terms of national averages or regional averages in the case of renewables. You know, they went with the North Carolina RPS for the whole Southeast. Well, is that appropriate? Is it not? I mean, you know, looking at independent power producers saying, oh, well, if you ran these, you know, but not taking into effect that, you know, that is a monopoly state and it's a regulated state. And to switch over to gas or to do all these things, ratepayers and the end users, customers, whether it's industrial, manufacturing, or residential, are going to end up paying for all this.
Hey, can I make a point on that? Because I have no doubt that you and others will poke a lot of holes in the numbers part of how EPA divvied up the allocations among the states. I have no doubt that there are problems. I have no doubt that EPA will revise them. And I have no doubt that there'll still be fights after EPA revises them. But my point is that fight is, I think, maybe a good fight to have, or at least a good discussion to have. And I think what EPA did here, they had to eventually do. This is this sexy architecture thing I was talking about. They had to, at some point, come up with some divvying up amongst the states, as fair or unfair as you're alleging right now. I'm making no bones about the specifics. But they had to divvy it up somehow with some form of a national overarching standard, whatever we might think of that standard. And so that's the part about this rule that I like. I think we had to get to that point. Now, you know, do we need to emphasize the renewable building block more? Yes, of course so. Do we need to focus more on the demand side? Yes, in my opinion, of course so. Are there going to be all these battles over natural gas and fracking in hot spots? Absolutely there will be. But the bottom line is EPA had to start somewhere, and I think this rule does get a check in a plus direction for at least doing that.
I mean, at a certain level, it tells states that have not done it or have done it in a more partial fashion that they need to begin to track this metric at the state level, be aware of their systems within that state in the power sector that, you know, have, you know, emissions direct or indirect, and, you know, get involved in it. I think one of the really interesting things we're going to see is that we have, you know, markets that developed on the basis of economic efficiency. And in the past, when we had controls on units and plants, they were added costs that would then get expressed in how those units would participate in the market. When we start to talk about environmental dispatch, all of a sudden, we're not talking about individual entities' own cost loading and what they'll bid to run in the market and those decisions. We begin to talk about coming out of a form of self-directed merit order, as it were, and into a environmentally directed dispatch. From a principal standpoint, that's a radical change for some of the organized power markets, which are often pointed to as the hotbeds of innovation, the ones that are having some of the most dynamic mechanisms that get the distribution level and other more efficient resources involved in them. So it's interesting that states have that option. And we're going to see, I think, a very big divide, because on one hand, it's much easier to deal with those options in a regulated jurisdiction than it is in an organized market. The organized markets are already set up around efficiency principles that would rather see this stuff put through those frameworks and in a cost loading, back to the point of carbon taxes, as opposed to trying to directly build the supply curve unit by unit on the basis of an objective or subjective sense of what its, you know, marginal intensities look like. So it's an interesting standpoint. It's also one where I think we're seeing the play right now as Congress is asking FERC, you know, guys, how is this going to affect our reliability? How is this going to affect the way our markets have developed? Because beyond the economic efficiency, the traditional constraints in our power markets have been for reliability. And so this would be adding another constraint around carbon, something that we've seen happen regionally and is moving forward on decent tracks, I think all can agree. But it raises a very big question. To this group, the question, when do you think FERC will substantively engage with EPA on the question about how this really does, if people choose to begin to reorder dispatch, how this does affect some of the ways that we measure, in a sense, reliability? It doesn't have to destroy it, I'll point out. It doesn't have to be in conflict, but maybe some of the ways we look at contingencies, some of the end factoring, some of the distribution factoring in our systems and so on are going to have to shift. So I'll throw that out there to everyone. What do you guys think?
What's becoming clear here is that the Federal Power Act is absurdly outdated. And when we're talking about the EPA rule's impact on reliability, there are two distinct worlds in the U.S. Vertically integrated, state-regulated utility systems, where reliability is not an issue, and the FERC jurisdictional markets, which they are redefining and redesigning on an almost monthly basis what qualifies as a just and reasonable rate in order to keep the lights on. FERC is kind of making up the rules as they go along, and it's getting a little out of hand. And I think Congress's inability to think big picture about how to make the Federal Power Act more relevant and better functioning is starting to be a real liability. And I don't think FERC commissioners have the tools they need to ensure that that they can continue to operate these markets in an efficient way.
When you say getting out of hand, I'm curious, because a lot of people, myself included, look at what FERC has been doing as a natural response of a technocratic organization, as technologies let resources at all parts of the grid be able to compete, you know, in the organized markets, energy, ancillary services, capacity, and so on. Where do you have the specific issues with, say, the problem FERC currently has in front of the D.C. Circuit around, you know, where the jurisdictional lines fall under the Federal Power Act? I'm curious if folks see that, you know, issue and what we're seeing EPA doing as intimately related or tangentially related.
Yeah, if I could just put a placeholder, I think Tyson's pointing out some very serious and significant issues with FERC that I think I agree with, but this D.C. Circuit jurisdictional issue that you allude to, I think, is hugely important to this issue. My understanding is that FERC has asked for an en banc hearing, which I think is going to occur. So I think that whole issue of the state FERC jurisdictional line is something that we may need to address at our next hot air show, but I think that's sort of in a pause mode right now. If the D.C. Circuit rules against FERC, as they did at the Court of Appeals level before en banc, then I think we do have the very problem that Tyson points out. If the umbank D.C. Circuit agrees with FERC, then I think it will give FERC some flexibility to deal with some of these issues. And I just want to point out on FERC in general, the FERC's response to this Obama climate plan is like FERC's response to all of these issues. Well, it might pose some long-term reliability issues, but we think we're okay in the short term. That is basically FERC's response to almost every government proposal that touches upon energy, I just want to point out. So it looks like in the short term we're okay with this power plant. I don't see FERC. I think there are issues with FERC, but I don't think the Obama climate plan is necessarily.
Well, there's a lot of issues with FERC. Have you ever seen it in such upheaval? I mean, three commissioners, two just got sworn in.
Yeah.
Okay, who's going to be the chairperson? Who's not? And now, you know,
It's really
and now Norris is taking off to this.
Tyrone.
I wish I knew the USDA had jobs.
Are overseas postings?
Yes.
I had no idea.
I mean, and, you know, so.
And just to point out, on the FERC state utility commission, there are some really exciting things happening at the state utility commission level in Minnesota, Colorado. I mean, again, it's sort of in fits and starts. But to me, the real big issue is, does this regulatory mechanism the Obama administration is creating have a prayer to slow down the natural gas juggernaut? And at this point, with the rule that we have, the answer is no. I mean,
and that's an interesting
that really
thing.
Is the central issue.
Some folks I've heard argue say that the ability, the kind of key architecture of the rule that lets folks go beyond the fence line to seek solutions to improve their, you know, their metrics, their, you know, carbon output metrics from stuff that isn't on site, that rule, if it went away under legal attack, would put all the more emphasis on higher performing, better heat rate generation like gas. That rule in and of itself exists as a flexibility for units with worse heat rates. And so, you know, I'm curious, Bill, do you think, you know, with that being the case, that we're, you know, that, but, you know, are we going to see a great variance if assuming beyond the fence line survives legal attack, which is an interesting question, are we going to see a lot of variance in how it applies around the country, but with the one common factor that there's just more gas? Is that basically what you see?
Yes, with various forms of cap and trade that states are implementing on the side, and maybe even a carbon tax a state or two may experiment with. But yes, I think that is essentially how it will play out, the way you presented it to me.
And from your view, if that includes, as Toby was pointing out, you know, existing units, you know, brownfields that are already there, that, you know, can ramp up capacity, existing capacity, to meet demand, say, as older units are retiring because they don't want to scrub as, you know, thoroughly as they're going to need to under the toxics rule, Section 112. Do you still see that as an issue, or is your view that gap has to be made up through efficiency or renewables almost exclusively?
The gap is going to have to be made up, but I would argue that the gap isn't that big or that challenging in the first place, and I think that while the way they come up with these 2030 accounting methods are a little shaky, if we really invested in renewables the way that we are capable of, we can meet the targets in this Obama plan. Now, the targets in this Obama plan are not science-based, but this does give us the architecture to do that. I'm just a little skeptical that, A, that we'll all have the fortitude to fight the natural gas beast, and, B, that we'll really ramp up renewables the way that we're capable of. I mean, those really are the two central policy questions that at least this rule keeps as an open question.
Wait, I'm not sure the gas industry is that coordinated to call it a singular beast.
are you saying that a 30% reduction by 2030 isn't science-based? That sounds very science-based to me. I say that sarcastically.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, talk to Jim Hansen. It's far weaker than what it should. And of course, the whole rest of the world uses 1990, 1995 years. We continue to use 2005. I mean, there's all sorts of things.
There's nowhere in this that has 2005.
Right.
That's right.
It's variations from 12, not from 5.
Right.
Huge problem. The projections embedded in that rule are optimistic in terms of what comes to the rescue, but pessimistic in terms of power demand growth. They have a very anemic embedded implied power demand growth, even in their sort of most bullish case where efficiency doesn't come to the rescue, less than 3/4%, closer to about 0.6%. And that is just... that's not how Americans are probably likely to live. It's not how they lived in California when they ran into problems before. We might grow at some point, in which point something interesting happens. It actually gets easier to meet all these targets. On a rate basis, if you end up adding lots of new generation that is, yes, gas. Oh, and by the way, beast? I thought that the natural gas was the cuddly hydrocarbon kitten. Like, it was the fuzzy little bunny hydrocarbon, right? It's beast. You're trying to suggest to me that there's some conflicts embedded in the choice. Well, anyway, but to the point in terms of what, you know, FERC involvement, I think you've dispatched rather effectively. But the reliability question is hard to ignore in the face of the most recent winter. And if you look at states like Massachusetts, which are 11% coal-fired, right, almost no dependence on coal, that fraction is up almost 6% from 2012 on the basis of what they needed when they needed it.
And what Kevin is citing is as we had the polar vortex descend, and it got colder, people used more gas, and you had a lot of people that began to have a lot of parts of the system where gas heating demand and gas generation demand combined made it so that the transportation basis, the cost of moving gas from the receipt point to the nomination or delivery point, started to exponentially clock the commodity cost of gas. Some of the arguments that have been out there when we talk about our overall gas future for this country is that our pipeline system actually does not really give us an accurate demand in view, an accurate view of what gas demand really would be if people could get it closer to the actual market commodity pricing without so much pipeline constraint, without systems where we have to backhaul through pipelines and so on. So it's it is a curious question as to a rule coming in place that could drive more gas generation in places where, for instance, we don't have the infrastructure and we get tighter on the pipe, which leads to more peakier times around, you know, events like this last winter.
Right. But America's Natural Gas Alliance, which is a trade and lobbying association for the gas producers, released a report almost a year ago, last fall, where they said to fully realize the gains in fracking production and offshore gas production, we're going to need an additional $641 billion of infrastructure development over the next two decades. So that is an enormous amount of required commitments in order to offset the kind of price spikes that we saw during the polar vortex. And that's one of the concerns I have, is that the attractiveness of gas isn't just its relative emissions benefits relative to coal when you burn it, but its price advantage at the current in the current market. But as we saw this winter, that evaporates in a hurry if you've got infrastructure constraints, which we are going to, and those are only going to intensify. And that's my big concern here, is that we're looking at asking natural gas generation to play a bigger, more central role in our portfolio at a time when I'm not convinced that it's going to deliver affordable rates. And I think that we could be challenged in the next few years with some more types of price spikes.
Just, I agree with Tyson's concern, but I do want to take issue with the scale of the investment as a, mm-hmm. as a bad or an impossible thing. Against a base of $3.5-4 trillion of energy infrastructure, $600 billion over 20 years is, well, it's not that much. And every bit of it is quite a lot of American employment and GDP, which is also good. We like that, at least I've been told we like that still. It may not be as insurmountable, and the number sounds very big without a denominator, but against the base of infrastructure, it's still doable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but to go back to Tyson's point, you know, that's one of our biggest concerns and challenges, is not only the infrastructure part, but also putting all your eggs in one basket for your customers. Because in regulated service territories, that fuel price is a pass-through. So when you hit that volatility, that's passed through to the customers. And who gets hurt? Especially people that, you know, that are on the margins, that all of a sudden, you know, they're looking at one energy bill, and because of something like a polar vortex, they're looking at a lot higher energy bill. And that's what we want to, you know, guard against, and that's why we you know, you hear about the industry always talking about diversification and all these different things. And if you have a program that is pointing you in one direction and pushing you, you know, you can have all the state flexibility you want, and I put that in quotes. I don't know why I did it on a podcast that you can't see, but whatever. Air quotes were used. And my children would say I have a timeout because that's a mocking. But, you know, you could say you have all the flexibility in the world, but everything's pushing you towards one thing, and that's more use of natural gas and you know, dispatch of natural gas a lot more. And if you look at the polar vortex and you look at a lot of our industry peers, Duke Energy's industry peers, a lot of the coal facilities that are scheduled to be retired had to be placed in service and had to be pushed. And what's going to happen when, A, you retire those or, you know...
Well, PJM just announced internal working groups, right, to develop essentially big new out-of-market payments for older nuclear and coal units. And this is what FERC is increasingly relying on. And these are the markets that are so easy to manipulate. And we've seen from the capacity auctions, which have been an utter joke, and we filed a big market manipulation case against this private equity firm in the New England market, and we're going to be filing something next week over Exelon's manipulation of the PJM capacity market. FERC does not have a handle on all of these out-of-market payments, and I am definitely concerned that in the name of reliability that PJM is looking to drastically overpay to keep some of this capacity on.
Well, those reliability must run contracts have long been some of the most sought after deals to get for units.
Oh, yeah.
Especially in the second half of their lifespan. They often are very good for the folks who are involved. But they're also a mechanism that have been along.
Depends on who's selling it.
Yeah, exactly. But
or if they say no, we didn't really mean for you to have that capacity.
Yeah. But it's a mechanism they've been around for a long time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's kind of a core function of the RTOs, or the balancing authority, or whatever level it is in that jurisdiction, to be able to say you really can't take this offline because it takes us to a part where we're worried that it's going to have a material impact on reliability. I think it's very interesting that that you're focusing more on those issues. I think a lot of people are focusing more. To FERC's credit, they have been looking more into the concepts of reliability, capacity, and so on. Some of the things that I think are coming down the pipe in the future are a more granular measure of reliability. Right now, we measure it over large zones. And a lot of times, those zones are not designed to be as sensitive to the actual manifestations of reliability as it happens at the community level. And as we see more distribution-level assets coming into the power system, I think that we're going to go to more nodal measures of reliability.
I totally agree with that, Chris, and I think one of the ways – that's going to happen in a lot of different ways. One of the ways it will happen is through the state implementation plan process of the Clean Air Act. I mean, that's one of the things about this proposed rule. There is going to be discussion of these things in the state implementation plan. Now, will that be the be-all, get-all? No, probably not. But will it be useful as a form of rationality? Yes, I believe it will be, more so than the state utility commissions have been on their own, that's for sure. The other thing I wanted to point out from what Kevin was pointing, with his numbers that he's, and I think those numbers are sobering, particularly on the demand side, is I think it, for different reasons, I think we all around this table eventually are going to want to embrace the beyond the fence line concept, not only from a climate mitigation point of view, I think that almost goes without saying, but I think most importantly from the perspective at least of Kevin and Toby, yeah, from the production point of view. I mean, that beyond the fence line, it raises just as many production issues as it does mitigation issues, and if you're stuck only with building block one, only with the efficiency of these plants, there's no way we'll solve the energy issue or the climate issue. So we're going to have to look at the, and this is the genius of Gina McCarthy's political, it's the states can have whatever they want to do. It's a literal, it's whatever.
But it's pointing. Yeah, exactly. But it points you in the.
Are state DPs ringing the party bell?
Yes, they are.
Because
these public commissions love EPA and federal regulatory agencies to tell them what they have to do. I mean, they love it, especially in the Southeast. I mean, but let me pose a scenario. What if South Carolina, for instance, because they just joined this suit about regulation under 112, therefore you can't regulate under 111. Let's say that they just say, that's it, and they basically flip a finger up in the air to the feds and say, we're not going to do it. So you get FIPPed. The EPA really hasn't done any kind of, like, talked about FIPP. Back in the past, and correct me if I'm wrong, what's the enforcement mechanism for SIPs? That's the fact.
Well, no, I was.
What's the enforcement mechanism? It used to be transportation dollars. People rarely ever get anything anymore.
Well,
right?
Well,
It still is. So what's the enforcement mechanism for doing? I mean, and then you talked about rate based and talked about, I mean, because you can't do multi-state with rate base, from what I understand. You have to convert it to mass base. And then the whole you know, equation for doing that is all screwed up evidently. And, you know, and this goes back to my initial talking, what I said initially about the reason we haven't really said much, because we're still trying to figure it out.
Well, I like to take it down to very, very simple concepts. As Kevin was pointing out before the show started, using wonderful squirrel logic, in my opinion. We're all connected with wires. Everything's connected. Wires connects everything. Squirrels can run the whole damn thing. But the what's interesting is a lot of the questions beyond the fence line really come down to the core issue that we've faced with climate change for a long time, which is if you are going to do something other than direct emissions at the emitting source, you're stuck with dealing with indirect emissions reductions, where if you have emissions reduction achieved in one place off a baseline, and it's, you know, on the demand side, or it mimics a demand side reduction. What ends up happening, especially in our competitive power markets, is at some point through a series of complex, you know, systems, a unit gets a dispatch. The dispatch signal goes away. The dispatch down signal hits, and they back down a portion of their output. Now, traditionally, it's been very hard to actually trace back. I know of only one instance where it's been done regulatorily, and that was what Deborah did with Montgomery County when they did their SIP with a wind purchase. But beyond what they did, which took basically retroactive dispatch modeling combined with continuous emissions monitor system data, combined with direct negotiations with the unit that they wouldn't include those emissions reductions, basically take emissions on their budget, as it were, although in this case it was at a unit that was in an area that didn't have a hard cap, so it wasn't a big deal. But the bottom line is there's a lot of steps and a lot of complexity at being able to assess how some of these building blocks will actually affect individual units discretely. So what we're going to have to ultimately do, in my opinion, is pick a proxy that doesn't work every time on an emissions factor or on an indirect emissions basis, but works for the most of the time, you know, generally.
And what would be your proxy factor?
Well, it's hard to do. Some would say this is why we have EGRID out of EPA, you know, sending general emissions factors for regions. I think bureaucratically, you know, to go to the point where you are actually, you know, trying to have it a negotiated question on indirect emissions factors with the unit that was backed down is going to be very difficult. Instead, the states, I think, will be able to ultimately design systems where they are factoring in the fact that we're working in a cap system, but through the mass-based conversion can do something that just gets translated into output kind of in and out. In other words, there's kind of a translation wall where it comes out of the unit from intensity to mass-based, into the market, into mass-based, and then when they purchase environmental commodities in that market on a mass basis, it comes back and converts the unit to intensity basis to work on the SIP level, state level, which is on an intensity basis. That's one formulation. There could be many different ones, but the bottom line is it's complex.
You know, we deal in regions of the country where, you know, that's a lot. The question is, do state agencies have the resources to compute all that stuff?
Is it going to be a party at the DEPs? I mean, and do that's a very good question. When folks have done this for carbon, using indirect emissions reductions, it's been an effort, and it's taken a lot of modeling and a lot of data crunching and so on. It's different from the types of work that DEPs are used to doing.
Before we get too lost in the weeds, and these are important weeds, but I just want to make a general observation, which is, I could be wrong on this prediction, but of all the things about this proposed rule that I think make it vulnerable to legal challenge, I personally do not believe EPA's flexibility on intensity-based standards or mass-based reduction standards is one of them. I think EPA is in a very strong place. Whether it's good policy is beside the point. I think EPA is going to repeatedly have the legal authority to crunch these numbers so long as it's not completely arbitrary. And I think we want that in the long run, even if we're not going to like the process. So we're really talking about coming up with state-based numbers. That is what this discussion is about.
And just to focus that point there, you think that ultimately the Supreme Court's going to grant Chevron deference to EPA over what they're doing?
Yeah, I see the Supreme Court being far more skeptical of outside the fence line type of issues. I think there are some limits to how EPA can go outside the fence line. They might be vulnerable there. I think on the numbers that EPA calculates on these state standards, I can't see the Supreme Court wanting to overturn them.
Look, it's true that states have a big challenge. This is a complicated rule, and I'm not sure that the states have the resources. But who does have the resources are the utilities operating in those states. And I think we can all understand that Duke, Southern, AEP, all the utilities are going to be running the show, right, in terms of supplying the numbers, saying this is what we can do to get in compliance. And EPA is going to be cheerleading from the sidelines that activity. This is what EPA wants to do. And it's so important to note the discrepancy between the fairly collaborative, coherent program set up by the EPA and the hysteria within the political system. And that's something that is actually very important. You know, you mentioned South Carolina joined with 11 other states to challenge this. You're going to have states that are going to have political systems and political bases that figure that they have a incentive to demonize and go against the rule, even if thumbing their nose at EPA actually puts them at a weaker position, it doesn't matter because the political party mechanism benefits by attacking the EPA. And it's this political irrationalism that is dominating too much of America's political debate at the expense of formulating effective policies that is the real tragedy here.
Tragedy? I think it keeps us all
democracy.
Very engaged. Yeah,
we're democracy!
Differentiation of opinion.
So
federalism.
While we're on that political point, because I think it's a very important point, Gina McCarthy, the genius behind all this, and a Tufts graduate, so I have to naturally agree with her characterization as the genius, will be back at home for home Red Sox games at Fenway by the time the multi-state plans, which involve all sorts of things happening, not just the coordination and the modeling, but also the legislative action at a state level, have to start getting realized. And all this has been sold as something that is basically efficient when you can run the big machine that is the grid as a big machine. And if you can actually run things regionally, or even better, get to a national trading program, then you'll get efficient outcomes. Otherwise, as EPA points out in its modeling, you'll get less efficient outcomes.
No, that's the patchwork potential here. And it's going to be very interesting to see how cleanly things like REGI, AB 32, Western Climate Initiative type efforts might sleeve into what EPA is doing.
Oh, it's going to be simple. I'm serious. This rule was written to allow all those things to pop through. There's no doubt to come through.
And it'll be interesting because when in patchwork, setting up linking directives amongst those regimes could allow for a uniform market to be created years from now, on the basis of how those go. But the discounting schedules would be massive. I mean,
but you keep bringing up REGI. REGI, the prototype of this multi-state, state legislative effort coordinated around a unified goal. And I can bring up New Jersey as an example of how politics can change this well-coordinated political overlay onto the mechanical...
Yes, and that is Tyson's point, which is that, all of this has to dig, next to the auger of the way our political system is.
Aren't we talking about this chiefly because of the political system?
I really don't want this discussion to descend once again.
Nothing could happen in 2009.
The pressing points about how fractured we are as politically. But I do want to take a point that you said, Tyson, which is that utilities are capable on handling this complexity. And I do think it is interesting. I mean, Toby, you guys do have some very sophisticated control rooms, and utilities all over the country are looking at getting more sophisticated on data, the management of their systems, having more controls, finer control over things. You know, is this, you know, from a utility perspective, is this one other aspect of just kind of a more complex grid of the future? Just another kind of, you know, bounding requirement over that more complex grid.
I don't know if it's necessarily the grid as opposed to generation. I mean, because ultimately you're going to have, I mean...
But when you have building blocks that allow for efficiency and demand side resources,
but if okay,
isn't it
demand side? Now? We're going to demand. How are we going to demand that Tyson, you know, reduces electricity? I mean, we can't demand that. And 1.5% compounded annually, it's asking a lot. Building block one, heat efficiencies.
But at the right time, you can incent him to do
that. We can try to incent him. But again, from a regulated standpoint, the PUC is going to be the one that ultimately decides that. You know, everybody talks about the grid of the future, the utility of the future. Honestly, I don't know. You know, if you look at the polar vortex, if kids would have gone to school that day in a lot of areas, people would have been running very thin. I mean, you would have had rolling blackouts. There were some in South Carolina with another utility in South Carolina. But because kids didn't go to school, that was less power that had to be, you know, sent over there. They were able to maintain. The capacity margins were very slim.
So successful EPA compliance depends on increased rates of homeschooling.
Well, that's correct.
This is an interesting dichotomy. You know, Bill's making the point that this is basically something to continue the gas train, you know, rolling on. And it sounds from your point that if the gas train doesn't continue to roll on, and importantly, we don't increase our pipeline capacity to fully tap our and utilize, I'll say, our gas resource, then this can't. What we're talking about here with this EPA proposal is going to have issues?
Duke Energy spun off its gas pipes 8 years ago, and now we're looking actually at investing in a pipeline infrastructure in North Carolina, you know, to try to bring more capacity, you know, to that area.
And if Bill, to you, does that just mean more fracking? Or you know, as some people will say, it just means more gas staying here.
There will be more fracking. I think the export issue will remain a live wire. And I think we'll have some successes on fracking, but in specific locales. I think in some places we're just going to get run over with natural gas. It's going to be very geographically based. I wanted to point something about the macro political posture of this that Tyson Starr and we all referred to, which is that the Supreme Court itself now, I think with the two Clean Air Act decisions in the past term, I think also is now sort of following this political ball a little bit, which is to say, A, they're no longer fighting about whether EPA can regulate carbon dioxide and climate. You know, that is clearly a done debate now. I mean, it was always sort of done, but now it's really done. And they've upheld the EPA's ability to deal with cross-state pollution, which was a big deal. And even on the issue where it really looked like they were slapping EPA's hands on the permit in the Utility Air Group case, really they didn't. Really they just took a small band of potential permits that EPA really wasn't issuing anyway and said, well, you can't issue them. 97% of the permits they were already issuing are going to continue to be issued. And by the way, those permits at issue in Utility Air Group, this is one of the ironies of the law and how it works, are basically meaningless permits. The permits don't even do anything.
But you know what? They will not sit on the dock and wave goodbye as the EPA. What was it? The EPA.
Yeah. But here's my point. This is that EPA is now driving all of this with FERC and with the others. Obviously, other market driver. But EPA is now driving large portions of this. And Congress is following. The courts are basically following. I mean, that is where what we've been left with.
Well, I wouldn't say that Congress is following. Congress has a complete inability to get together on comprehensive energy or climate issues. Congress was given the chance, you know, at the beginning of Obama's term. And before that, there were a lot of opportunities. And utilities and other stakeholders wanted desperately an alternative to this EPA process because this was seen as the worst case scenario. But Congress's inability to come on very simple agreements means that the worst case scenario is now what everyone has to live with.
And it's very interesting because when, you know, if you hit rewind and you go back, you know, 15 years, when the carbon debate was really starting to get going in D.C., the concept was the Clean Air Act wasn't written for climate change. It wasn't written for carbon. It's not specific enough, and so on. You zoom forward to today, and you look at a lot of the wins that EPA has had at the Supreme Court and others, and basically you could boil a lot of that down to the Supreme Court saying, yeah, the Clean Air Act isn't quite specific enough, but in its general framework, you have deference to do this.
Mm-hmm.
It captures it. And I go back to this observation, a lot of the flexibility that you see in this rule is very similar to the flexibility that was seen in clean energy standard proposals and so on, which was meant as a federalist approach to an issue, notwithstanding the inefficiency of the market patchwork cut, notwithstanding that inefficiency. So it's something that we're going to have to see if, once again, this march back into the Federalist Laboratory, led by EPA, ends up working.
Yeah, so the very framework of our union is being tested by this, the new battlefield for 10th Amendment conflict.
It's all the fight, it's not the result, but yes. And, I mean, we'll see. But what's also interesting is where all this falls. I mean, we are only a few months off of the 2016 campaign starting here in D.C. Unfortunate that it creeps several months forward every year, every cycle, but it does. And so we're getting close to it. Practically, there's a very slim chance that all the issues around this rule are going to be resolved when that comes. How do you guys see this playing in that campaign cycle? Is this something that the Democrats can frame as we're doing what we have to do in the absence of congressional action and leadership on this, and we're giving the most flexible thing forth that we're doing? Or do you think it's going to ultimately play that this is just another manifestation of a big bureaucratic, you know, government mess that has established too many forms, too many checks, too many requirements in a system that's ultimately going to be inefficient to achieve its goal?
I think it's going to dominate the Republican primary, no question. It's going to be candidates elbowing each other about who can vilify the EPA and its various initiatives the most. In terms of the general election, it really depends upon the condition of the economy at the time. If the economy is sluggish or doing very, very poorly, then you can absolutely guarantee that the EPA is going to be held up as one of the core reasons why you've lost that job recently.
Do you see, though, any of the balanced, kind of all of the above aspects of some of the rule helping to mitigate some of this, or is it categorically going to be a football?
So much money has been spent
introducing
people to the EPA as an out-of-control bureaucracy intent on destroying U.S. jobs. And that's a narrative that permeates, right?
Even when EPA does nothing.
Right.
So,
it's going to be very difficult to say that the EPA is actually a champion of an all-of-the-above strategy. The Democrats, Obama has absolutely been one of the biggest promoters of fracking and natural gas, and it gets him zero credit.
But
if you ask the general public, he is anti-fossil fuels, period, and he's a radical environmentalist.
He gets some campaign funds in his coffers as a result of it, so it doesn't hurt him all the way. And I was going to just point out about Obama's everything for everyone climate plan is it certainly is consistent with the coronation of Hillary Clinton. There's nothing inconsistent with the Obama climate plan and what's going to happen with Hillary Clinton in 2016. So there's a lot of space for her with that plan.
She's not even going to run for president.
But I also think it plays into the larger narrative of government overreach, that the liberals want to just continue to overreach and things like that. And what's really going to be interesting is the 2014 elections. You have the ability of the Senate to flip. So you have Republican House, Republican Senate, Democratic President. The way that they frame oversight will play into the 2016 elections. And the Senate becomes more, looks more and more Republican day by day, with Senator Walsh saying that he's not going to run because of, of academic problems. Yes, exactly. Yes. So that's going to be an interesting dynamic. But I also think that this whole rule plays into the larger thematic of the government overreach. The government, you know, that whole...
Even with the state power, even with so much of the framework authority residing
at
the...
Because you're saying that it's flexible, but you're pushing them in a direction, and you're making... This goes back to our whole sarcastic tone about the PUC is going to be, you know, cheering and things like that. States don't want the federal government to tell them what to do. But, in the larger theme of presidential politics, I actually don't think it changes any of the states. I mean, you basically boil down to two states, Ohio and Florida. Mm-hmm. And all the rest are going to fall where they fall.
Yeah.
Can I to contextualize what you're saying, Toby, and really what you're saying too, Tyson, is that there's a political fight that this enables, and if you say Republicans are against it because of doctrine, that's half of the story, but it's not the whole story. As a share of wallet, Americans are spending less on energy writ large than they had been the last couple of years. It's down to about 6.56% on a national basis. Republicans, or the states who voted Republican in the last presidential election, are at 7.24%, and the states that voted for Obama in the last election are at 5.97%. So 1.25% of my money is enough to care, right? It's actually true that these happen to be red states where they drive longer distances, have colder winters, and they feel this stuff, which means that this issue does resonate in a way that it doesn't just fall into a simple demonizing EPA. It actually speaks to the question of whether the economy has made people rich enough they can shrug it off.
And that goes back to the, you know, will this return to resource politics issues? But right now, it appears that it's staying politicized. Any final points from the group? Let's not end another hot air show about how politicized these politics are.
Can I end with a gift that I have for all of you?
A gift?
A gift. I know, this is so... convenient, but I wrote a Larry article entitled Frostpaw Addresses Global Warming. Frostpaw is the center's polar bear mascot. Solving a big problem with old legal tools and new administrative systems. It's all about how the Clean Air Act is going to solve all of our problems, going to solve the climate change problem, and here is my prediction. I think that no matter what happens in 2014, no matter what happens in 2016, 2018, and even 2020, when we look back in 10, 15 years at this moment, it was when the Clean Air Act did become established as one of the vectors by which we solve the climate problem. Is it enough? We don't know yet, but it's going to be here no matter what.
Here's the sad part. For Congress to act, they would have to see Frostpaw floating down the Potomac River on a sheet of ice.
Bill, when you said gift, I was thinking watch or Nats playoff tickets, but I'll take it. Thank you.
I'm putting this right under my Frostpaw poster.
We will have the next hot air show at a rate more frequent than this one has been to its predecessors. But thank you, everyone, for joining us in the heat. We'll see you next time.